Hi, welcome back to another episode of DD Geopolitics Pod live stream. I am your co-host Sarah with the co-host Chris, and I'm like a lazy Sunday kind of, but there's still a lot happening. How are you doing, Chris? How was your couple of days? What have you been up to?
It's great. I'm having a great time. I'm so energetic. I'm in St. Petersburg now, aka the heroic city of Leningrad. I've had a chance to see places where Tsars were hanging out, the Hermitage, museums, sarcophagi, who knows what places where emperors were assassinated, beautiful churches, and it's just unbelievable. This is what a wonderful civilization and a fusion of people. So very happy to be here with you all. And of course, the news has not stopped. We've got plenty for you in store.
We do. And Nick joining us as always, getting to work on a Sunday afternoon, first and foremost. I was going through the YouTube comments, which I do go through them. We all go through them from time to time. And somebody said about last week, and I told you guys, I was like, you guys are going to hate me after this episode, or I'm going to make a lot of people upset. Somebody commented and said, the only person Sarah rivals in her rudeness is Katie Halpert. Okay, so two things. One, I don't think Katie Halpert is rude at all. I really don't. I think she's that's got sort of like a little bit of the Jewish sass, like the vocal fry, but that's probably about it. And two, if I was rude, I apologize. I'm sorry if I hurt your feelings. And I mean that sincerely. I don't want people to think that I'm being rude. Maybe I'm just being a little too blunt. Maybe my autism kicks in and I get a little too blunt.
Are you neurodivergent?
Yeah, I am. I am. And I have PTSD. It's just, I'm a mess. So people are like, what are you laughing at? This is not a laughing matter. I'm like, it is. If I don't laugh, then I'll just have a panic attack. You know, it's like none of my emotions are correct. Most people just think I'm crazy. It's fine. We make it through. But you just got done. You were on Galloway. So guys, if you didn't see Galloway, go check that out. We're not going to do as in-depth an update on the Epstein book as he did over there. But Chris is working tirelessly for the American people all the way from St. Petersburg.
Always.
Trying to get the Epstein info into the right hands. This location rollout. Chris, did you look at your location on X?
Yes.
What did you get?
It says United States. So everyone's like, oh, he's like a Russian agent, you know, from the US. And I'm like, okay, so here's a picture of me in front of the, you know, Church of Christ spilled, you know, blood. And here I am. I'm here in St. Petersburg. And they're like, it's a fake picture. It's an Indian in Russia. I was like, okay, bro. All right. If you say so, I won't keep you with your delusions.
This is so funny. The first night I was like, I'm just going to make my own. And so I made one that said Burkina Faso for me. And then Jackson wound up getting Burkina Faso. And I was like, that bitch that I'm stuck with United States. Somebody posted, I think it was late. It must have been late last night early this morning, but somebody posted a screenshot of ours, DDG's, and I didn't know it was going to do this. I'm glad it did, but it says Slovenia for ours. And they posted a screenshot and wrote, not even American, by the way.
As if it's a bad thing.
There's a map on our website that shows every country that we have a contributor in. We're very proud that we are not American. It was very bizarre. Like, these are, the Houthis say, thank God, thank Allah, our enemies are so stupid.
Yes. Well, you know, the funny thing was Jackson today posted and said, Elon, please change my location to communist China. So I did the same, and I said, please change my location to victorious Russia. So here we are, and the victories are continuing on the battlefield.
I'm shocked. I'm happy we got Slovenia. Somebody needs to represent Slovenia, and if it's us,
absolutely,
then I'm more than happy to do it. Also, guys, we did spontaneously start our reading club last night. We might do another one today. But last night we did Cuba and Vietnam, and next one will be Korea. The Korean War. Chris would probably enjoy that one. Absolutely. So definitely, maybe we'll get around to it today. If not, the recordings are up. Guys, it's just casual. No pressure. We read it together. It's super fun and super cringe. But it's for the autists and the people who maybe just want like a chill Like, and that's not screaming about the Duke for 3 hours.
Can we also say that Yugoslavia, like, okay, Slovenia. Yugoslavia is awesome.
Well, let's get it changed to Yugoslavia. Let's see if we can finagle that.
Like, Tito had like some class, you know, like that kind of like 1955 after Bandung, you know, non-aligned. Everybody's, you know, ready to fight the Western imperialists, but also, you know, carve out their own path. Yugoslavia was pretty cool as a country. It really was.
You know what's funny? So we were talking about fascism last night.
Thank you, Amujan. We love you.
they're just happier out of Africa. But I asked an AI, I don't even remember which one it was last night, but to give me examples of benevolent dictators, because I was like, who would be a benevolent dictator? And it named Tito. And I was like, that's interesting. I don't think I would have thought of Tito, but all right, benevolent dictator, Tito. So whatever that is.
Why not?
Today we're coming off of a kind of a rocky week. We had a, well, it depends, I guess, on how you look at it. I was a little, not black pilled, just a little forlorn about it. And today someone said, you know, MTG resigning is actually a white pill. So maybe I did cut her resignation video down. So let's take a look at some of the parts that I wanted to point out.
Americans are used by the political industrial complex of both political parties, election cycle after election cycle, in order to elect whichever side can convince Americans to hate the other side more. And the results are always the same. No matter which way the political pendulum swings, Republican or Democrat, nothing ever gets better for the common American man or woman. And today, many in my children's generation feel hopeless for their future and don't think they will ever realize the American dream. And that breaks my heart. My bills, which reflect many of President Trump's executive orders, just sit. They all sit collecting dust. That's how it is for most members of Congress bills. The speaker never brings them to the floor for a vote. Many common Americans are no longer easily convinced by paid political propaganda spokespersons and consultants on TV and paid shills on social media, obediently serving with cult-like conviction to force others to swallow the political party talking points. Because they know how much credit card debt they have, it's all so absurd and completely unserious. If I am cast aside by the president and the MAGA political machine and replaced by neocons, big pharma, big tech, military-industrial war complex, foreign leaders, and the elite donor class that can never, ever relate to real Americans, then many common Americans have been cast aside and replaced as well. There is no plan to save the world or a 4D chess game being played. When common American people realize and understand that the political industrial complex of both parties is ripping this country apart, that not one elected leader like me is able to stop Washington's machine from gradually destroying our country, and instead the reality is that they, common Americans, the people, possess the real power over Washington, then I'll be here by their side to rebuild it.
What do you make of this? Well, let me point out a few things that she said. Political industrial complex. These are the things that I love. Please love, please. I'm not glazing MTG. We're just giving her flowers for this speech. We're not glazing just yet. Political industrial complex, obviously two sides of the same coin. They feed off hate every election cycle. She talks about the loss. This is a big talking point. She uses the loss of the American dream, especially for Gen Z. Obviously millennials suffer as well. I thought that it was very interesting. She pointed out bills on both sides collect dust. Even my bills that are in line with Trump's policies. She calls out the influencers, which I thought was super important. She says, you know, Neo is becoming a party of neocons. We talked about with you guys a few weeks ago. We said the neocons are looking for a cover. They're looking for a home. You know, they're suffering huge losses and their home is now MAGA. She said, if this party is going to be neocons, big pharma, big tech, the military industrial complex, foreign leaders, and elite donor class, which is a phrase that just is starting to become part of the conversation. I mean, we've used it before. People in our circles use the words, but I've never heard it being talked about regularly and sort of mainstream. She says, there's what we've been saying this whole time. There's no plan, guys. There's no 4D chess. There's no plan to even trust. And that the people united is the only way we will defeat this machine. Is like, wow, have we not been saying this since before Bernie? We will not vote our way out of this, is what she's saying. Nope. Is this her laying herself across the tracks, or is this kind of her giving her last FU? Am I allowed to do that on YouTube?
It's a finger.
giving her last FU to the to the kind of establishment and saying, you know, I'm, you can't fire me, I quit, you know? Or is it like really her kind of throwing herself on the sword and saying, you know, no one else is going to say it, I'm going to say it, but I'll be here when you're ready.
Mm-hmm. Listen, I'm convinced. I saw that we went almost live with it. It was immediate. We were on top of it and we immediately posted it. For me, when I saw that video, I thought to myself, number one, this is a woman who's taking a lot of heat from the most powerful man in the United States, if not especially in the Western world. So she, of course, is taking a lot of heat. Her family's taking a lot of heat. She's, I'm sure, getting plenty of death threats. She's got all the defamation, libel, slander, you name it. But I think that there's two ways to understand this. Number one, she's basically saying, if I honestly believe in fighting this system, then I can no longer change it from within. And I think that that speaks to me personally, because that's why I left, you know, that's part of why I left the military. I said, if there's no way to enact change and to end this war on terror and to really change course, I'm out of here, because I'm not fighting these imperialist wars. And that's why I never deployed abroad. I never fought in those wars. So I like that. That screams to me a conscientious objection. Like, I'm no longer going to participate in this evil, corrupt, degenerate system. Number two, it sets herself up very nicely for a political comeback as an outsider, basically saying, I'm here to take power back and I'm here to bring the voice.
St. Petersburg doesn't have internet as good as Moscow.
She could definitely do that. She could definitely do that. And I think that it's very clear that she's setting herself up for a long struggle and a political career to come.
I agree. And, you know, I don't all doubt the authenticity of it for things like this, because as someone, and you spoke on your own, anecdote, but as someone who kind of did have their epiphany while being inside of the system, I think I always my radicalization point was in, I hate the word radicalization, but my wake up was in 2016 when they showed me as a training session, instead of doing training videos, they showed us our pilots bombing indiscriminate targets in Syria. And I was like, this is weird. And then it gradually got worse after that. And so I don't doubt the authenticity of seeing the inside of something. And also people giving her a hard time about waiting until her pension kicks in. I also don't care about that. Girl, get your bag. Like, get your bag and go home. I didn't mean to, but I was medically retired. And that's, you know, are you supposed to refuse it? I don't know. I mean, I was told not to. So it's like, I don't know. I don't doubt the authenticity. And I am just, I know that working inside of systems like that actually a lot of times leads you to have that sort of wake up call.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I agree. I agree. I think that this is a real reckoning for the political class. I think this is a real reckoning, a real moment. And I think that this is going to be one of those axial moments that we talk about, especially in political history here. Because I don't think it's only going to be Marjorie Taylor Greene. I think that there's going to be more political fallout from what's coming. And I think that there's going to be a real reckoning in the next 12 months. I mean, we right now are November 24th, at least here. It's November 24th in Russia, November 23rd there. Imagine a year from now when we've had congressional elections, when we've had all of the midterm elections, there's going to be a real political realignment, I believe. And at least there's going to be shockwaves throughout the system. And I don't think it's going to be exactly what the Trump administration is believing is coming next year. I think we're going to see some real seismic shifts to come.
I agree. I do too. Thomas Massey sat down for an interview just before the resignation video of MTG came out. I haven't seen his reaction, if there is one, or anyone's besides Trump's for that matter. But this is him talking about whether or not MAGA is tearing itself apart. Chris and I have gone over this many, many times about the Fisher kind of becoming a MAGA versus America First. Here's Thomas Massey on the same topic.
Do you think that MAGA is torn apart? Marjorie Taylor Greene said it yesterday. The party, people are fighting all the time. This whole thing has really been, there's a lot of different sides forming. And do you still feel aligned with the Republican Party as it is right now?
You know, I vote with the Republican Party 91% of the time. And that makes me a heretic in the Republican Party. Because right now, the president demands 100% compliance. Mm-hmm. On any given day, if you're not in 100% agreement, you're a traitor to him. Like with Marjorie
Taylor Greene. That's like a cult.
And Marjorie is for all the same things she's always been for, right?
Right.
Less war overseas, balancing the budget, getting to the bottom of the Epstein files. These are things we campaigned on. And so when the president strays from the MAGA, you know, mission, then...
Why is he straying?
Then Marjorie and I are trying to pull him back.
Why is he compromised?
I don't have any knowledge that he's compromised.
You don't think there's any stooges pulling the strings, a puppeteer?
I think what happens is you get insulated. I think he was more in touch with what Americans wanted when he was going to rallies every week.
Because he must not be reading the comments.
And but at some point, you know, you can't just say, oh, he's got bad advisors. Ultimately, the person at the top is responsible for everything, including the advisors.
So you do believe Trump's running the show?
Yeah.
You don't believe foreign governments are running the show?
I think he's running his own Twitter. And that's on the brunt of it.
Guys, just a point of advice. That woman is a terrible interviewer. We saw an interviewer like that. I was like, I watched the whole thing, and the whole time I'm like, he's going the right way if you just let him go that way. But she's there to be like, you don't think it's Israel? You don't think it's Israel? You know, like she's like, so anyway, don't interview people like that, please, especially not Thomas Massie, who's a very kind of chooses words wisely and isn't a very like high-strung individual. But they did go on to talk further about Epstein, which I thought was interesting. And this is just a tiny update on the Epstein files and Thomas Massie's, and then we'll move on from the sort of the congressionals, I guess.
Do you believe Netanyahu's involvement with Trump is influencing the decision of the Epstein file release?
I think Israel is influencing the Epstein file release because Israeli intelligence and our own CIA was wrapped up with Epstein. And so it would be embarrassing to our own intelligence agencies as well as Israel's intelligence agencies for all that to come out. And if you notice, there are a lot of bots online and people who are paid. Maybe they're not robots, but they are paid. And they're going after Marjorie and I uniquely. And I think it's because we are against the war that Israel has in Gaza right now. And we want that to end. And we don't vote for foreign aid. And we don't vote for military aid for these other countries that are at war. And we get in trouble for that.
Do you think Epstein's still alive?
No.
And do you think he was a Mossad agent?
Let's talk about agent. I think he helped Mossad.
Was he collecting blackmail on our politicians, and that's why no one wants these released?
You know, I don't know if it was blackmail, but let's say you were a drug user and you bought drugs from a drug dealer.
Ben.
I'm not sure that he was blackmailing his clients, but he was definitely getting favors from them by finding them women and offering women to them. So I'm not sure. And then obviously, once you've done enough of that, there is a lot of blackmail material.
People are saying that you're acting like a Dem, a dirty Dem. You're a dirty Dem, Thomas.
Well, this was, you know, what's interesting about Epstein is the president said it was a hoax, but now he's going to investigate the hoax, right? When he announced all these investigations.
Yeah.
And then he also encouraged everybody to vote for it. So
why is he so mad at reporters, too, that are asking about the files?
Fake news. You're fake news.
Is it fake news?
No, it's not fake news.
So there's all your answers from Thomas Massie and a horrible interviewer with, Shelley, an incredibly short skirt. Let's point that out. Girls, ladies, no. You really shouldn't be wearing skirts above your knee at all if you're on the Hill. But I digress.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
they need to go to Russia. They really need to go to Russia and just see how women dress.
One would hope so. One would hope so.
Well, speaking of crimes against humanity and fashion.
Here we go.
No, I'm just kidding. Trump met with Mom Donnie. See, celebrating this. We are celebrating Trump's Nas Bowl arc. Are you guys excited with us? I'm just so excited for Trump becoming a Nas Bowl and sort of really embracing the horseshoe theory. But my question is, why the hell did Trump And I didn't really talk to MAGA after this, but why the hell did Trump let Mamdani dog walk him around that office like that at your house, bro? Mamdani dog walked Trump. So let's go through some of these clips in a very strategic order, because you know me. But the first one, this is about Elise Stefanik. And just so you guys know, Elise Stefanik was the ambassador to the UN. Now she's running for governor of New York, backed by the millions and billions of the Adelsons.
Please. Mr. President, Republican Elise Stefanik has campaigned multiple times by calling Zohra Mamdani a jihadist. Do you think you're standing next to a jihadist right now in the Oval Office?
No, I don't. But she's out there campaigning. And, you know, you say things sometimes in a campaign.
Isn't that sort of
She's a very capable person.
But you
really have to ask her about that. But no, I don't particularly. I think I met with a man who's a very rational person. I met with a man who really wants to see New York be great again.
So he kind of says Elise Stefanik is wrong, which is Elise Stefanik is one of his pets. So we're building a little bit of our narrative, spinning a little bit, but yeah. So first, that's it. He's not a jihadist. Now Trump would know a jihadist.
He had one of them. He had Jelani in the office. He met one.
We know. He's experienced in jihadism.
See, I just want to say this is the beauty of the American system. You can fund, arm, and train people, call them jihadists, win the war, then bring them and baptize them that they're not jihadists, actually, they are. And then you can baptize somebody a communist, socialist, jihadist, and then bring them back in and say, actually, the American system is something unbelievable, really. It really is a place where your dreams can come true.
Right. Well, Trump says all the time, you know, I'll talk to anybody. Cool. I'm the same way, Trump. I get it. I'll talk to Nazis. I'll talk to Zionists. I'll talk to everybody in between. But I did look on Elise Stefanik, who was calling Mamdani a jihadist, and not one peep about Jelani or the Jelani visit. Suspicious.
Interesting.
Does Elise Stefanik celebrate Christmas? No. So anyway, this is the next one. This is a... Just don't forget Mamdani called Trump a fascist.
I want to clarify your answer to Stephen Nelson. He asked about your comment calling the president a fascist. And your answer was, both President Trump and I have been clear about our positions and our views. Are you affirming that you think President Trump is a fascist?
I've spoken about...
That's okay. You can just say yes. Okay. It's easier. It's easier than explaining it. I don't mind.
And Mr. President, I wanted to ask you also about this Ukraine plan.
Yeah. Listen,
he's in front of his face.
Listen, I posted this video and I, of course, said the classic line that is DD Geopolitics, like golden plaque above our doors. You know, it's one big club and you ain't in it, because that's it. Oh, yeah, it's OK. Don't worry, bro. Don't worry. Wallah, it's
just say I'm a fascist. We still can get along. Words have no meaning anymore. Just say it.
Public, welcome to the big club. Welcome, Mamdani. Welcome. We're going to get some good deals. We're going to get Come on. I mean, listen, at this level, once you're in, you're in. It's like, you know, it's like getting accepted to an Ivy League school. Since I've attended some, I can tell you. Once you get in, you never really fail. Like, you have to work extra hard to fail. If you just coast, everybody graduates. And nobody asks you your GPA when you graduate Harvard, Yale. You know, Bush graduated Yale. I don't think he had the same GPA as, you know, Ted Kaczynski graduating Harvard. But I'll tell you one thing. Nobody cares about the GPA. Just like nobody cares about how many votes you got, this, that, you're in the club. Welcome. Take a seat. Whatever we say is for public consumption. Behind the scenes, let's do some business.
That's how it is. So now we're going to find out how Trump feels about New York City.
Would you feel comfortable living in New York City under a Mamdani administration?
Yeah, I would. I really would. Especially after the meeting. Absolutely.
What makes you comfortable?
We agree on a lot more than I would have thought. I think he's, I want him to do a great job, and we'll help him do a great job. You know, he may have different views, but in many ways, you know, we were discussing when Bernie Sanders was out of the race, I picked up a lot of his votes and people had no idea, because he was strong on not getting ripped off in trade and lots of the things that I've practiced and been very successful on, tariffs, a lot of things. Bernie Sanders and I agreed on much more than people thought. And when he was put out of the race, I think quite unfairly, if you want to know the truth, many of the Bernie Sanders voters voted for me. And I felt very comfortable, frankly, in seeing that and saying that. And, you know, it just turned out to be a statistical truth. But no, I feel very comfortable. I would feel very, very comfortable being in New York. And I think much more.
Okay, so as a New Yorker, he's already saying this is now he's saying in the face of everybody who said, we've got to leave New York. It's no longer safe. Sharia laws. Shakira.
Shakira's coming.
It's all coming, right? Trump's saying not only is it not coming, I feel safe still living there. It doesn't even matter to me. I would go.
No, yeah, of course. No problem.
Exactly. It keeps getting worse. This is, I can't even imagine the huge amounts of cope on both sides of the aisle, but communist and the despot.
Thank you very much. Any questions, please?
President Trump, Stephen Nelson from the New York Post. I've got a question for you and then also one for Mayor-elect. Sure. For you, you've referred to Mr. Mamdani as a communist. Could you describe why you feel that way?
I feel very confident that he can do a very good job. I think he is going to surprise some conservative people, actually, and some very liberal people. He won't surprise them because they already like him.
And Mr. Mamdani, it sounds like you had a productive discussion, but just days ago, you referred to President Trump as a despot who would betray the country. You said you'd be his worst nightmare and accused him of having a fascist agenda. Are you planning to retract any of these remarks in order to improve your relationship?
I think both President Trump and I, we are very clear about our positions and our views. And what I really appreciate about the president is that the meeting that we had focused not on places of disagreement, which there are many, and also focused on the shared purpose that we have in serving New Yorkers. And the meeting came back again and again to what it could look like to lift those New Yorkers out of struggle and start to deliver them a city that they could do more than just struggle to afford it, but actually start to live in it.
And I've been called much worse than a despot, so it's not that insulting. Maybe I think he'll change his mind after we get to work it together. Yeah.
So Trump refuses to call him a communist, which is, and then Mamdani refuses to walk back the despot comment, and Trump agrees with it. Not that I don't necessarily think there's anything terrible about being a fascist despot. Jokes, but for him to not even walk it, he's like, yeah, I'm not gonna walk it back. You're a fascist despot. Like that is what it is. It's very interesting.
Listen, it's all a big mumble jumble word salad. Nobody cares. It's all, I look at them. They're just like, oh, well, you know, we agree. We disagree on a lot of points, but we also agree on a lot of things that we're going to serve New Yorkers. Okay, meaningless. What do you mean you're going to? How are you going to serve New Yorkers? This is politics 101, everybody. Politics 101.
Here's the coup de grace. This is the climax.
So that's good for New York, good for everybody. But I just want to congratulate. I think you're going to have hopefully a really great mayor. The better he does, the happier I am. I will say there's no difference in party. There's no difference in anything. And we're going to be helping him to make everybody's dream come true, having a strong and very safe New York. And congratulations, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Please.
I appreciated the meeting with the president. And as he said, it was a productive meeting focused on a place of shared admiration and love, which is New York City, and the need to deliver affordability to New Yorkers, the 8.5 million people who call our city their home, who are struggling to afford life in the most expensive city in the United States of America.
There's no difference in party.
There's no difference in anything at that. There's no difference. What difference?
You know? Spot, okay.
Listen, it's the inversion of St. Paul to the Galatians. St. Paul says, there's no Jew, no Gentile, no, you know, man or woman, all are one in Christ. In this sense, there's no Republican, no Democrat, no gay, no straight. All are one in mammon, power, money. That's it, you know, that's the truth. That's the truth. You don't need a Bohemian Grove. Bohemian Grove is sitting there right in front of you. It's right there in the Oval Office. That's Bohemian Grove.
Yeah, it really is. And this is the last one. This is less jokey, and I'll get your thoughts after it. But I thought this was like really just another slap in Trump's face.
I would like to ask Mr. Mamdani, you've accused the U.S. government of committing genocide in Gaza while President Trump was working on peace. Why that?
I've spoken about the Israeli government committing genocide, and I've spoken about our government funding it. And I shared with the president in our meeting about the concern that many New Yorkers have of wanting their tax dollars to go towards the benefit of New Yorkers and their ability to afford basic dignity. And what we see right now is we're in the ninth consecutive year of more than 100,000 school children being homeless in our city. And there's a desperate need not only for the following of human rights, but also the following through on the promises we've made New Yorkers. And I appreciated the meeting we had and the work that we can do.
You agree that President Trump did do a peace and work hard to make the peace, because he worked hard to do the peace in the Middle East and everywhere. What do you agree with that?
I appreciate all efforts towards peace, and I shared with President Trump that when I spoke to Trump voters on Hillside Avenue, including one of whom was a pharmacist that spoke about how President Trump's father actually went to that pharmacy not too far from Jamaica Estates, that people were tired of seeing our tax dollars fund endless wars. And I also believe that we have to follow through on the international human rights. And I know that still today those are being violated, and that continues to be work that has to be done no matter where we're speaking of.
Damn. He said, no, I said Israel's committing a genocide and we're funding it. Yes. And Trump nodded along. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And we're sick of funding it with our tax dollars. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Listen, I'll say genocide call out. Excellent. Hats off.
I'm not giving Mamdani props. My point here is, what's going to be the backlash on Trump? Israelis and Zionists are all about optics on those sorts of stages, and sure, Trump didn't push back at all when he said genocide.
He didn't. That's what I'm saying. So props to Mamdani for slipping this in there, mm-hmm, right? Because it, in a way, it was a tactical move. And in this case, it worked. Like, Trump didn't say, whoa, 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 whoa. Like, it could have happened. Excuse me. That didn't happen. Excuse me. Fake news. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. Did not happen. So in that way, props to Mamdani for sort of like, you know, teeing that up and sending it. But you see, again, at the end of that, word salad, endless wars, this and that, bro. We've been on the shtick forever. I mean, is it the Tulsi train, you know? Endless wars. Yes, we all agree on the endless wars. But what's actually being done about it? Call out the real, you know, powers that be.
Yeah, and he like just stopped short of specifically saying like, they're still being genocided. Your peace plan is crap. Like he said it, not in those words, right, but right, yeah, he needs right to be a little bit more specific. But I really thought that it was important to point out that he did slip in that thing about genocide. And I don't know that I've seen any, but I'll go looking for it after the stream. I looked for it yesterday, but I didn't see any response to that or any. It's kind of just, maybe we'll just ignore that and not do a Streisand effect to it was what they figured they would do.
Right. I want to say the following. Mamdani is being groomed by the same people that groomed, in the sense of politically groomed, mm-hmm, AOC.
Oh, sure.
So you can totally tell the language change now. Mm-hmm. You can totally see sort of, okay, we're at bipartisanship again. And yeah, okay, tax the rich, but actually like, mm-hmm, funding this and that. Mamdani's already playing into that. And we see here, somebody mentions in the chat, smooth operator. Absolutely.
He is.
Operator is here now. That's, mm-hmm, what happens once you get that kind of position. Everybody comes. Even President Putin has said the suits come and they tell you what to say, what not to say, how to say it. And that's it. You got your talking points, you got your cards, and you go. And when you mumble, when you go off the reservation, so to speak, like Biden, when he would start to mumble and kind of go off, that's when he would get foot in mouth and the whole political establishment would be in an uproar because he talked out of line.
Well, speaking of Putin, Trump's next foray, his next war that he's going to end for next year's peace prize. Trump gave a full 28-point peace plan. He's really good at these plans with a lot of points. Now, I don't know why, but Ukraine got more points than Gaza. Gaza only gets 21 points. Ukraine got 28.
28.
28 points. This is the biggest, best point plan you've ever seen. But alas, it's drafted by Steve Witkoff, Marco Rubio, Jared Kushner, who coordinated with, now, no disrespect to the Russians, Kirill Dmitriev,
yeah, who, yeah,
it's kind of a jester in a way. I don't know how to describe him. He's there to kind of be the bridge between the Americans, yes, and the Russians.
He is the bridge, that's for sure.
Okay, so the United States delivered the plan to Zelensky on what they said was an aggressive timeline, and they were told that they must engage. And I want to go through some of these points. You talked about it at length with George Galloway. These are also super vague. Like, I read through them again this morning. Number two, it just sounds exactly like Minsk. Number three is Russia will not invade neighboring countries and NATO will not expand further. We said not that? 1 inch in the 90s. Why would Russia take this guarantee? Like, everything is stuff that, like, you've already said this and broken it.
Correct.
Is that the general sentiment in Russia?
Yeah, the sentiment, listen, the liberals are all up in happiness that, oh, okay, you know, things could be happening. And the Russian press has been sort of kind of also ceding that territory, that this could be the moment. But in terms of the hardliners and the much more patriotic crew, no, we're going. We're going all the way. Like all objectives will be achieved militarily. Nobody has any illusions of this. Right. And I think that tends to be the correct position. Why? As we'll see, already today, the situation has changed.
Exactly. So in the plan, a global, like it's very much redundant or very much reminiscent of what they do with Gaza. Obviously not as severe and disgusting because it's white Europeans or maybe whiter. They're not quite white to the Americans, but whiter, somewhat European peoples. They get a global reconstruction package, which yep. some Ukrainian development fund that we're supposed to believe they're not going to just swindle and run away with. Russia gets to be reintegrated into the global economy. I wanted to ask you about this. Does Russia want the amount of reintegration that they had prior, or now that they've kind of had these guardrails in place and they're kind of standing on their own two feet, now is it like getting back on SWIFT is a plus and we'll accept it, but we're going to continue to do things this way as well?
Listen, I think that a lot of Russians understand, the ones who are in the know and sort of like political watchers. I think most people who aren't are sort of like, let's get this over with. Let's get back integrated because I want to go back to shopping in Italy and France and Switzerland and all that stuff, which is not going to happen. Even if everything goes this way, the Russophobia is like enshrined in Europe at this point. So I don't think that that's really going to happen even in the medium term. However, I think that most watchers will say, wait a minute. Okay, we do this. We agree on reintegration. 2 years from now, the Americans have elections, and then a Democrat comes to power, and the Democrats tend to be even more Russophobic and pro-European, and then back to sanctions, back to square one, you know? So I think they're saying, look, some level of reintegration, not full reintegration, and now we've chosen our own path of development. Certainly, there has to be some economic issues sorted out, but in the bigger picture, Russia has been able to withstand a lot of the economic coercion and economic warfare that's been leveled against it. And it's been able to weather it in a really profound way, to the point now where European diplomats, American diplomats are basically saying, not only that, Steve Bessin, right, wasn't it, basically said, the Treasury Secretary,
Scott.
Right? Scott, thank you, Scott. Basically said, Scott said, oh, it's actually not working, right? Scott said it's not working, right? Steve Witkoff has said that it's not working either. But Scott Bessin has also said it's not working. Just to show you that everybody is sort of in agreement that this isn't working at this point, right? And I think that that's the key here to understand this situation, is that they haven't worked, and reintegration will open the Russians up to even more pressure down the line if they do it too fast and in the wrong ways.
Exactly.
So I think they're very careful about it.
Exactly. And then there's a lot of other crap in here. It's sort of like Russia will never accept that, which is their assets being used to pay for the rebuilding of Ukraine.
Oh, absolutely.
Both sides.
$100 billion. $100 billion in frozen Russian assets. That's an enormous quantity. That will not be tolerated by the Russian side at all. And they will, what will end up happening is if they do that, the Russians will retaliate and then these negotiations will crumble.
Next, that I thought was interesting was education and social programs promoting multicultural tolerance will be mandated in both countries. You think for 1 second Putin's going to let you come up in his schools and teach his kids anything? The LGBTQ movement is a terrorist organization in Russia. You think they're going to let the Westerners come in and teach the kids?
No, and they're not going to teach the kid that, oh, Bandera was a freedom fighter and he fought for Ukrainian self-determination and national liberation. No. No, he was a Nazi and all the Nazis had to get a bullet. That's it. End of story. No ifs, ands, or buts. Nobody's going to tell the Russians what to teach in their schools. And they already teach multicultural tolerance. Russia is a multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-religious state. So I don't know what else you want to teach them. There are Muslims, Orthodox, Jews, atheists, agnostic, Hindu, Buddhist, whatever you want, Tengris, shamanic, what anything you want, anything you want. You know, so I think everybody needs to just chill about this. That point is not going anywhere on this side.
Very much a duplicate of the Gaza one, though. That's another reason why I pointed it out. It's very much like we just took the Gaza plan, maybe ran it through AI and said, adapt this to Russia,
Ukraine. For sure.
Well, Putin did respond. Let's take a look.
Because the goals of the special military operations are being achieved.
through armed warfare. But as I said many times before, we are ready for peaceful talks. We are ready to resolve the issues in a peaceful manner. This, however, requires detailed discussion of all the details of the plan that is being proposed. We are ready for that.
So we're going to continue to use arms to achieve the goals of the special military operation. And I think that he was in a way pointing out that this peace plan is quite vague. And it is. If you guys do read the word for word, I'm being a little bit broader than it is, but not much. It's very vague.
Very vague and very open-ended. Nothing tangible. And the Russians have said time and time again, we've repeated it here ad nauseum. The Russians have said the root causes need to be addressed and they need to be solved before any peace is achieved. Or else it's an open wound that'll fester and war will come again.
Well, and Putin was also kind enough to give us his personal update on the front, so I don't have to. Fantastic. Thank you, Putin.
There you go.
Recently, on the 4th of November, I believe, 2 weeks ago, basically, Kyiv publicly announced that there are no more than 60 Russian troops in that city. And within a matter of days, the city, they claimed, would be fully deblocked by Ukrainian troops. But let me inform you that even back then, on the 4th of November, the city of Kupiansk had been completely claimed by the Russian troops. Our guys were cleaning up blocks and streets. The fate of the city had been sealed by then. What does it tell us? Either the Kyiv leaders have no information on the situation on the battleground, or they have that information, but they can't evaluate it properly. If Kyiv doesn't want to discuss President Trump's propositions, if they refuse to do that, they and the European warmongers must realize that the events in Kupiansk will repeat inevitably in other key sections of the front line, maybe not as quick as we would like it, but inevitably they will repeat.
So
that's it.
Then we got this video from since we're celebrating the communist communist fascist alliance or communist monarchist alliance.
Мы находимся в центре Покровска. Центр Покровск взят российскими войсками, полностью зачищен от хохлов. Мы находимся в роддоме. Сегодня 23 ноября, вечер.
Покровск.
There it is.
Center, communists. I love it. Like, we get, like, you don't know if you're going to get a communist flag, a victory banner, a czar flag.
Listen, at this point, all the flags together, they're all good with me.
That's why people in the West don't understand that they think like that there's this still this weird like hanging where people in Russia fight like, I love the Tsar. Oh, I love the Bolsheviks. It's like everybody in Russia loves both for the most part. Like, I don't
know. I posted a picture on the front, like a victory banner next to the Jesus, you know, the
people don't understand it. I should post a video. I have one of the videos of one of the Cossack brigades, and they met up with I think they might have met up with Prizrak, but they had communist flags and the Jesus gonfalong. They were holding them both up.
Yeah, but the problem is that they were like, oh my God, Nazbol or fascist or Russian. Like, no, it's just the fact that the Russian Federation has different historical trajectories and tries to kind of coalesce them in one harmonious whole. Yes, there were good things in the imperial time, there were good things in the communist time, there were bad things in both, and let's try to figure out how to create a modern state. And there you go. And that's just it, you know. Sorry that people in the West can't handle it.
Exactly. And of course, Rebar put together a map. You can see that pocket is just about closed in that area. And so we gave you the good news from Pokrovsk. Here's some of the bad news from a Ukrainian MP on what's going on.
Україна буде думати, як діяти з громадянами. Тому що мільйон людей стоїть на передовій, скажімо так, в Збройних силах. Більше 500 тисяч людей – 200. Більше така ж кількість – 300. А як з родинами, як з ними, за що вони гинули?
Ви такі цифри зараз називаєте. Ви впевнені, що це так? Тобто 500 тисяч вбитими?
У нас?
Так.
Ну, я вам образно сказав. Ага. Ну, я рахую, що ці цифри можуть бути більше, наприклад.
Now that's big for the Ukrainians to admit that. I told you figuratively, but the number's probably higher.
Oh my God, I'm sure it's higher, but I've
we
never
know
heard
that it's higher, but for them to say it on TV, an MP to say it's, we have a million casualties. Like,
for sure. We've never heard that before, really. I haven't heard that before from a Ukrainian MP. You know, those kind of figures. That's big. That's big. It shows a change.
I agree. Well, of course, we couldn't have gotten through this without a counter plan from the Europeans. So let's give it a shot.
We have agreed on the main elements necessary for a just and lasting peace and Ukraine's sovereignty. And let me highlight three of them. First, borders cannot be changed by force. Second, as a sovereign nation, there cannot be limitations on Ukraine's armed forces that would leave the country vulnerable to future attack and thereby also undermining European security. Third, the centrality of the European Union in securing peace for Ukraine must be fully reflected. Ukraine must have the freedom and sovereign right to choose its own destiny. They have chosen a European destiny.
So they want it to be in NATO, EU, they want full access to the Dnieper River, et cetera, et cetera. The list goes on and on and on. You guys can agree. You guys can read it as well. What are your thoughts on the counter? It's all just shit-lib nonsense. It's like liberal.
No. It's total nonsense. And of course, like, for example, must unconditionally return all deported or illegally displaced Ukrainian children. Once again, we've been through this before. Mm-hmm. There are no illegally displaced Ukrainian children. All of them were rescued and saved. Many of them have been, reunited with family members in Russia, because it's not like they don't have family members. There's family members on millions of people on both sides who have family on both sides. Full prisoner exchange. Okay, we get that. But for example, again, Article 5 style arrangement, once again, a major stumbling block. Ukraine's NATO membership depends only on internal alliance consensus. Once again, major stumbling block. So again, the Europeans are basically trying to basically fumble this purposefully because they want to. But you see her tone. Her tone is much more muted. Why? Mm-hmm. Because also within the European Union, there's not full consensus, as we know, Orban, Fico, and now in Czech Republic. So we're seeing also a transformation within the European Union itself. But they want to continue this. And everybody knows that. They want to continue this war. They don't want to see it end. And it's a big political strength for them to continue this war, because it cements their power ultimately. They have been unaccountable all these years for the money they've spent, the arms they sent, and everything like that. Wow. And if they are held to account, that's where everything begins to crumble.
Not so fast, Mr. Halali. Not so fast. The demand is to change the language to give all parties full amnesty for their actions during the war. Zelensky ain't giving this peace plan unless he gets absolute amnesty. Also, they've also added a clause providing post-war amnesty at Ukraine's request to reassure Zelensky and members of his government that they wouldn't face prosecution if the current corruption scandal widens. We've covered this corruption scandal in depth. We've talked about Zelensky's time coming. You know, the jig is up. It's looking like that. And if he gets this little amnesty, they might be able to be like, we'll give you amnesty for all, and you can keep the 100 million and get the F out of our face.
I saw that as well. That would be amnesty, I assume, for the Ukrainians and the Russians. Do you think it would also apply to the Europeans? And if it applied to the Europeans, mm-hmm. then they would have been openly for the first time admitting to be party to the conflict. They've been supporters of the Ukrainian military and government in terms of not as a party to the conflict. We understand it as party to the conflict. They've never promoted it that way. I'm saying that if that amnesty gets applied to Ursula von der Leyen and her clique, who also are corrupt, we know that. I don't know how deep the corruption goes, but I guarantee you a lot of corrupt people in Europe who have been making a lot of cash on what's going on there.
Being told that it's just amnesty for the stolen money, not the war crimes, just so our viewers know as well. They were asking about all the war crimes since 2014. It's just for the money and the corruption scandal. That's it.
Correct. So the big question becomes, who does that encompass and envelop? Like, who's protected by that umbrella of amnesty? If it's not wide enough, you're going to begin to see other, you know, dominoes fall, so to speak. But if it's too wide, you're going to then have the political backlash, which is that this whole thing was a rigged war from the beginning for a, you know, get rich quick scheme on the backs of, you know, a million plus dead. That's the real political crisis to come, guaranteed.
Oh, absolutely. And they're putting a lot of pressure on Zelensky and them to come play ball. Like news just came out that Zelensky might come to Washington, and they said, you ain't coming here unless this. So this is Trump's response if Zelensky doesn't want to play nice.
Then he can continue. Then he can continue to fight his little heart out.
He can continue to fight his little heart out. And of course, Trump ranted today, a little first crash out of the Sunday, inherited a war that should never happened. They continue to sell massive amounts. But this line right here, Ukraine leadership in quotes has expressed zero gratitude for our efforts. And Europe continues to buy oil from Russia. So I think Trump's getting pretty fed up.
For sure. No doubt about it.
Then here's the Ukrainians after the meeting today with Rubio. I think they might be a little bit frustrated too.
Yep. There's the broken pen.
And I don't even think Russia's even said anything yet.
No, they're just sitting on the sidelines watching this unfold.
Yes. Like, do nothing. Win.
All right. We'll see what happens.
Well, this is the next segment I wanted to do, our second to last segment. But if, Chris, if you have to go, I know it's late in St. Petersburg, feel free. But we are talking now about Jonathan Pollard.
Yep.
Speaking of corruption and messiness. So ex-spy Jonathan Pollard and U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee, held a secret meeting at the U.S. Jerusalem embassy. For our viewers, this is the same Pollard whose espionage exposed U.S. sources, blew collection programs across the Middle East, and forced multiple intelligence overhauls. I don't even think we've recovered from that. The CIA has never minced words about the scale of the damage that he caused. Do you have any details you want to about the Pollard, just the case and then him going to jail? And for our viewers, I know that it was NSA docs and stuff like that, but I don't know the full scope of what he handed over.
He handed over, from what I understand, from my reading, he handed over entire networks of assets, personnel, and various information that was used to unravel a lot of what the CIA had built over the previous decade plus. So when you look at that, that's a lot of time, manpower, agents, resources, and even people who died in the field trying to build all that. He exposed it because he basically played the double agent here. But his true loyalty was to the state of Israel. No doubt about it. No question about it. And he did everything for the state of Israel. Of course, the biggest question is why. Why would he undo the CIA and the United States' network at the behest of Israel? And I'll save that for a little bit later.
Yeah, because I'm just sort of now learning. I mean, I knew about the case. I knew in the Navy, you learn about stuff like this. You have to do a training on him every year. So I knew about him in that sense. And I knew who he was. And I knew a little bit about the history. This is the first time I'm digging into it from like my own personal self-driven research. And I'm like, this guy's a total piece of shit. Like, he is a horrible human being. And I can't get over that there's not more outrage about this visit, but I guess it's a very opportune time to kind of reveal these things while so many things are going on. But the arrogance of this guy. So Huckabee has outlined, Pollard urged President Trump to keep Huckabee in his post. Who the hell are you? that he's better than anyone that he could imagine. He says about the CIA, these people are not friends of Israel. And frankly, I wouldn't even consider them friends of the Trump administration. The whole CIA needs to be cleaned out. The entire CIA station at the U.S. Embassy should be sent home. Why are these Israelis so adamant about this CIA team at the embassy? Okay.
Yeah.
So I just thought that that was a kind of weird. So he does give an interview to the New York Times, but this is a little long. Bear with me. But this is an interview he gave to a stream.
You met with Ambassador Mike Huckabee. Why did you meet with him?
I had reached out to him through my lawyers for a meeting. Why? It was a very simple personal reason. On one hand, I wanted to thank him as honestly as I could for everything that he had done on my behalf when I was in prison. And on the other hand, I wanted to extend my heartfelt appreciation for his kindness and his consideration towards my wife, Esther. There were other things discussed. There were pleasantries discussed, but those were the only matters of substance that transpired between us. Now, when I was contacted bolt out of the blue by the New York Times, I was somewhat surprised because they're a newspaper that I don't exactly like and never in my wildest dreams would consider giving an interview. But something told me it was important that I do talk to them. And after discussing, you know, my possible run for the Knesset, the subject of the interview became very clear, and that was the Huckabee meeting. Now, it was very clear to me, Daniel, that there was somebody in the embassy who had contacted a superior, perhaps, back in Washington, and that person had contacted the New York Times. It was clear that whoever contacted, made their superior in Washington aware of the meeting, didn't know the substance of the meeting. They were not privy to the meeting. It was clear to me also at the time of the interview that if the meeting was going to be used as a weapon against the ambassador, perhaps to have him recalled.
I got this from the substance of
the interview. Right. It's quite clear. And my guess as far as who may have been involved in this matter, I think is centered on the CIA station at the embassy.
I guess that the CIA station probably hates you.
Yeah. And when they became aware of it, I think they organized this hit on the ambassador. You have to understand, I have a lot of disagreements with President Trump, but there's one thing that we're both in agreement on, and that is that the CIA needs to be purged completely from top to bottom, from leftist progressive holdovers, going back to the Obama administration, certainly the Biden administration. I don't trust the CIA. They're not friends of Israel. I know this, unfortunately, from personal experience. And so this story now is, I believe, part of their effort to have the ambassador removed.
I'm not sure how to even like unpack this. The guy who spied on the United States for Israel is now giving us advice about our American spies in Israel. And then, you know, like he lets it slip out the real reason why he's doing this press tour, you know, this run I'm doing in the Knesset, you know, but, and that's really why. So that makes me think he leaked the story. It feels like a strategic leak. They had probably a small, stupid meeting, like old friends. Maybe there was some shady stuff discussed. It's Mike Huckabee. But I bet that he strategically met with Mike Huckabee to later leak this story. He knows he's a controversial figure. He leans into the fact that he's a controversial figure. He leaks this story. He makes it sound like the CIA and the embassy isn't to be trusted. I'm only looking out for you. Oh, and by the way, I'm running for the Knesset.
So, yeah. It's a psyop in that way. Totally.
When you think like a campaign.
Exactly right. Think of it this way. Why would we take, first of all, think of the language he used. I don't trust the CIA at all because it's a bunch of progressive leftist holdover. Wait a second. Hold on a second. Didn't the CIA kill all the progressive leftists during the Cold War? Like, I'm just confused here as to what's happening, actually. You see the kind of mind games they're playing? So the CIA actually kills millions of communists during the Cold War, right? Overtly and covertly. And then Now you have people saying, oh, the CIA in a McCarthyite way, oh, they're full of progressive leftists. They are. If you mean liberals, yes, there are liberals in there too. But progressive leftists of the sort of vein that he's trying to allude to, he likes like the boogeymen of Marxism. It's just not true. Nobody with the right sense will go in there unless they're spying for, you know, for a communist country, at which point stay the line, comrades, continue the good work. Salute you and your patriotism.
I have to disavow.
Yeah, but listen, but I want to say that this could totally be an opportunity to not only promote himself, but to do sort of the tension within the Trump administration and within the society about Israel again. Back again, put Israel at the center here.
Right. Because Israel, if it were just person to person, they would take Mike Huckabee's side over Trump. But yes, the positional power obviously makes Trump more advantageous. But Mike Huckabee is very much a beloved character of Israel. And I didn't know this, but this has been his pet project for decades. Here's Mike Huckabee 14 years ago.
Governor Huckabee joins the recent calls to act in benefit of Jonathan Pollard, who has spent more than 25 years in U.S. prison for spying for Israel.
He pled guilty. He served an extraordinary length of time for the crime that he was convicted of, to which he pled guilty. And it would seem to now be, a matter of good will and a good faith gesture for the president to give clemency and release him.
Now, this goes back even further because it goes back to the 90s. Benjamin Netanyahu tried to blackmail Clinton into pardoning Pollard with the Lewinsky tapes. So blackmail is all around this guy, too. So, and Huckabee's involved, you know, the Christian evangelical Kufi Zionists have been lobbying for his release forever. Could you imagine as an American being like, let me lobby for the release of the guy who put us in grave danger, who handed secrets over that eventually wound up to this? Well, we're going to actually hear more about it in this Tucker clip. This is I'm going to butcher his name, Sagar and Jenti. And Jenny?
Yes, Sagar and Jenny, yeah.
And he was on Tucker 4 months ago. So they were talking about this back in July. Here's the clip.
I mean, let's take the case of Jonathan Pollard, who's one of the biggest traitors in the history of the United States for passing classified information on to the Israeli government. Prime Minister Netanyahu used to visit our soil and actively campaign and urge our presidents of the United States to pardon Jonathan Pollard for betraying our country to his country.
Do you have any idea what they did with the classified information, secrets?
Well, I actually have no idea.
They gave them to the Soviet Union.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
And this was in the 80s, during the Cold War.
It was 1985.
It was 85.
Right.
Yeah. I remember it well. Yeah. I lived in Washington. The full focus of the U.S. government was was in opposition to the Soviets. And the Israelis gave a lot of that classified information from the U.S. Navy to the Soviet government in exchange for allowing refuseniks, you know, Jewish Soviet citizens to move to Israel, mm-hmm. which I'm totally for. I mean, I'm glad that they got out. I'm glad they got out of the Soviet Union and made it to Israel. That's great. But they took our secrets and gave them to our main enemy, our really only global enemy. Mm-hmm. What?
Yeah.
Right. And in the 80s, no less. So kind of trying to, most of our viewers are younger. I wasn't born when this happened. So, and obviously Chris wasn't either, but just to give our viewers the idea, in the 80s of handing our secrets over to the USSR, our parents were doing nuclear drills under their desks. So think about it that way, like handing our secrets over to the boogeyman, the monster. And this is the guy that these people have been advocating for: leniency, pardons, clemency, early release, etc. He's eventually paroled. There we go. Anyway, so he's eventually paroled and Trump actually pardons his handler. I think that was in 2017. But when he is paroled, he obviously is flown to Israel on an incredible private jet supplied by none other than Sheldon Adelson before his death. Here is Jonathan Pollard and his wife Esther arriving in Israel.
Thank you.
People call us traitors for like posting the news online.
I know.
Nobody's even talking about this guy meeting with our ambassador. Anyway, Jonathan Pollard obviously lives in Israel now with his wife. He's a very, very far right member of the of politics. He's trying to get into the Knesset. He's obviously received Israeli citizenship upon arrival. And I just have one more clip to show you his views now. This is recent. This happened after the genocide began and the blockade on Gaza.
I mean, it's hard for me to admit this. We are now feeding our enemy. I mean, this has never happened in history before, and you have to ask why. And I don't want to hear this business that it's consistent with Jewish morality. It isn't. Anybody saying that doesn't know anything about Jewish morality at all. I was criticized very heavily for opposing the ceasefire, the American-imposed ceasefire in Lebanon on us. And I was told by certain people in the government, look, we didn't have choice because we were being threatened with a complete cutoff of arms. But I said, you're mistaken if you think there's never a choice. There was a choice. He said, well, what? Is it to have our weapons cut off? I said, no, let me bring you back to October 1973 during the Yom Kippur War when Henry Kissinger instituted an arms embargo against us. He stopped the aerial resupply of our army at that point to extract diplomatic concessions from us. And what happened? What happened was an A-4 Skyhawk was parked at Tel Nof Air Base with some interesting weapons under its wings. And we told the Americans, take your eye in the sky and take a good look at the airplane that's on that runway. And the next day, the airlift started. So the guy that I was talking...
Which airlift?
To Israel, uh-huh. The arms arrow.
So in other words, we threatened their...
We threatened to use unconventional weapons. I'll leave it at that. And so he said, is this what you want us to threaten now? I said, absolutely. Except this time I want us to go forward with it if necessary. If they think we're bluffing, we go forward with it.
So the guy who says the CIA in the embassy in Jerusalem needs to be cleaned out because they're not with us, meaning Israelis and Jews, also wants to nuke America.
Wow.
And nobody cares that he met with Mike Huckabee. And wow. I'm now that like we've kind of talked this out and I've kind of bounced it off you and gotten your feedback as well, I'm kind of certain that that was a setup on Mike Huckabee to later use against him, that meeting in general, to now do stuff like this. Now he has a platform.
Now he has a platform and his name is back in the media, which people love to do occasionally, throw it out there, you know, throw a grenade, see what happens. Moreover, I think that because he's going to be, he most likely will get into the Knesset at some point. He's like a hometown hero. Imagine that the U.S. is funding Israel and he's going to be on the receiving end of some of those funds, all while at the same time speaking about destroying the U.S. in this case, or even harming U.S. interests, or even promoting Israel's interests over the U.S.'s interests, whether that be there or abroad. I just think that a very dangerous guy. And he's a true believer. He's a true believer. Yeah.
Obviously. And you brought up a good point. Sorry I didn't mention it sooner, Anisha. Thank you. Levin's son-in-law was there too at the meeting at the embassy.
Yeah.
You know what? The short leash that Levin tries to impose on Trump and the whole administration. So, of course, the other handlers there. Now I'm even more so thinking that if this was a setup, Levin's involved. And Jonathan Pollard said that the reason why the meeting even came about is because his lawyer. Why would your lawyer want you to go to the embassy and thank Mike Huckabee for helping you?
I had no lawyers do that I know.
Go thank him at a cafe. Like, why?
Send an email. Send a card.
It's bizarre. Send a Hanukkah card. Like, what do you do? Send him 8 of them. Like, I'm not really sure. All right. Well, before we go, I'll end you guys on a high note. A nice.
Well, I want to ask a question. I got to ask a question because you brought it up. How did Netanyahu have the Monica Lewinsky? I always call him Zelensky. The Lewinsky. How did Netanyahu have
the fat lady? What was the fat lady's name? Was that Linda Tritt? She handed them over to a Mossad agent, I believe, in Washington, D.C., if I remember correctly. They were all in on that blackmail with Monica Lewinsky. That was a Mossad operation.
So hear this out. So Mossad's in D.C. getting intel on a sitting U.S. president, blackmailing a U.S. sitting president for a foreign interest.
Yeah.
For a foreign country. And then people are calling Marjorie Taylor Greene and Massey conspiracy theorists and traitors for saying that there are real concerns about foreign countries and a specific foreign country that's doing this work. This is known information. This is public information. This is not a conspiracy theory. I just want people to understand when we're talking about not only in this case, Monica Lewinsky, okay, you know, one thing for the president, but when we're talking about Epstein, and we're talking about much wider networks and deeper networks. Who knows how deep the rabbit hole goes?
These people they really don't get it. They think it stops at like girls on a plane and some underwear models from Victoria's Secret. The blackmailing of Bill Clinton led to the creation of Kosovo. Do you guys not understand how this stuff has created and influenced foreign policy? We have evidence that Epstein was writing speeches for Ehud Barak in regards to the fake false flag chemical attacks in Syria. I don't understand. I don't know that people are understanding like the gravity of that. And this could be, I've got blackmail on you. I'm going to write your speech, or, you know, I've got, you know, this is how this is going to go. And that's, you don't know how these things went, but we do know that they directly influenced policy to create trafficking circles and ways to enrich themselves, money laundering circles, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep.
I'm trying to end on a high note, turning a new leaf. So I leave you guys so you guys put nice comments on YouTube that I get to respond to. This week, we accidentally invaded Mexico. I don't know if you know that or if it slipped under your radar. It slipped under many people's radars. I was actually talking about it in a space lesson. I was like, oh, so we invaded Mexico, da 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 da. And I'm like describing it. And someone goes, what year was this? I was like, Tuesday? Oh, yes, we invaded Mexico on Tuesday. A team of unidentified men, which were later confirmed to be DOD contractors, arrived on a beach in Mexico, and they installed 6 signs on the beach and declaring it Department of Defense property and a restricted area. The Mexican Navy came and found them, and they like almost exchanged fire, but like just stopped short. And instead of cleaning up their mess, they left the signs on. So the poor Mexican Navy.
Oh my God. Seriously?
Yes.
And of all the names of the Mexican beach, is what I'm hearing correct? Playa Baghdad?
Yeah. Playa Baghdad.
Maybe they got lost. Maybe they thought it was the beach on the Euphrates or the Tigris.
Said, you know what? We're using all our old tricks. We might as well go back to Baghdad.
Oh, my God. Just when you thought it couldn't get any worse.
You almost, when you live in the United States, you almost feel unsafe, not because it's about bad things are, you're like, of how stupid the people in charge are. You're like, I feel unsafe because, like, it's just, it's so bad. The circus never leaves town.
Wait a second. I want to know. How did U.S. DOD hired contractors mistake the Mexican side for the American side and commit a quote unquote navigation error? I just want to know how this happens.
I don't really.
Anybody? Bueller?
I want to go back to Baghdad. The real Baghdad.
We got to go back to Baghdad. We have to go back to Baghdad. Okay, Arbaeen, next year we're there. That's it.
It's so magical. Arbaeen, guys, I won't rave get about it again, but Arbaeen is like, if you can go, we should organize like a big trip next year and get like a group of Muslims, American Muslims that have never been to go, because it was the most beautiful. And everybody, I almost felt selfish that I was not a Muslim and I was there. I was like, a Muslim that never experienced this should be experiencing it. It was so profound.
Should we do DD Geopolitics like tours?
Arbaeen tour. Yeah, that would be so dope. Talk to our friend.
We could do Arbaeen tour. We could do Russia tour. We could do.
Did you wish your girlfriend was?
Yeah, you didn't know. We're also, DDG is very good at dancing. You can ask this beautiful lady here. She knows what happens when the Arabic music comes on. Oh, crazy.
Well, I think Chris is getting tired because he's getting delirious. So we'll go through Super Chat Sunday Fun Day. Thank you always joining us and always supporting us, Mo. First time catching the show live. Thank you for joining us for the first time. And thank you, as always, Nick. Nick is such a good friend to the show. His show is great. If you guys aren't checking out Nick and Savvy Sabs and all them, they have great guests. And they're very active, especially if you're in the United States. That is a show to watch. Very plugged into the movements and political movements in the United States. Chris is brilliant on everything, but you were brilliant on George Galloway. Again, guys, if you didn't catch it, he just was off George Galloway. If you want an update on the peace plan from him and George and the black book, it's on its way to the committee. And lastly, Will, thank you so much. As always, we will see you guys on Wednesday. Don't forget to stop by for book club if you have time. Yes, Chris is Greek and Persian, and go to Savvy Sabs right now. She's about to stream. Have a good rest of your weekend and get ready for Turkey Day.
We'll see you all soon.
See you all soon.